Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, fellow Toledoans, you may have heard the story that came out that Toledo has the second worst rate of mental health among mid-sized cities. So what's that all about? Well, where this comes from is from data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and they have a 500 cities project where they keep a set of data on 500 different cities, and you can go compare them. I looked all over the web, and I could not find the actual comparison of where they came up with us being the second worst. Also, I couldn't find out how they defined mid-sized cities. But I'm not too surprised by this, and I'll get into this in a little bit more detail. This is actually a pretty good case study in actually some basic statistics, though. The first question I'd have when I hear something like this with a ranking is that many times they look at just what I would call a nominal ranking. You look at the crude rate of, say, prevalence. In this case, what it happens to be, which was not really reported on, the indicator is that your mental health was not good for 14 or more days in the last month among adults. And for Toledo, there was a 17% prevalence. 17% of people reported their mental health not good for 14 days or more in the last month. And that 17% is compared, for instance, for across the U.S. as a whole, 12.4%. And that 17% versus 12.4%, 4%, that's an absolute rate of 4.6% difference. Or if you compare the two rates together, Toledo's rate versus the United States rate is 33% higher. 17 is 33% higher than 12.4 when you look at that relative to one another, not the absolute difference in the prevalence percent. Okay, so getting complicated already. Okay, going back to the ranking, when you see things rankings, a lot of times what people do not actually compare, which I would have liked to compare, but since they didn't say what the number one city or the number three or the number four or five was, there's no way for me to go back and compare this. But you have to look at what you often see in statistics, and like if you're reading any kind of scientific paper, most types of scientific papers, or you're looking just at public polling, they'll talk about confidence intervals or the range of uncertainty. And usually what they're talking about is what they call 95% confidence intervals, or from a statistical point of view, they say a p-value of less than 0.05, which is 5%, meaning that there's less than a 5% chance that those results are due to chance just from sampling issues. And of course, this gets very complicated from there. So I apologize for people where actually for some people, this is really basic. For I would say actually for the majority of the U.S. population, this is actually pretty complicated. And it's very difficult to do the reporting and talk about it where people understand. It's very easy to get misunderstood. So Toledo's a depressing city. That's the headline. Let's get this into a little bit more detail, and let's look, broaden it besides just this one mental health indicator, and let's look at how Toledo compares to the United States among a whole bunch of health outcomes and what's the other prevalence of unhealthy behaviors. So what I've done is I've gone through and picked out these ones where Toledo is quite a bit higher Actually, there really isn't ones where Toledo is lower than the United States in this particular set of indicators. We will get to some Ohio indicators where we do a little bit better on some of these things. Okay. So, also when you're comparing rates or prevalence of something in a population, the most basic thing that you do in public for public health statistics is you adjust it by age. In other words, the age distribution of people that live in Toledo is different than the United States. So, of course, diseases that are very much related to age, like a lot of chronic diseases, you would want to have that to make a fair comparison. Is you'd want to adjust that based on the differences in population. You know, so you may actually have a population, say in Florida, where you've got a lot of old folks, but maybe compared to other old folks, they're doing really well, but they look a lot more unhealthy than, say, a very young population, which actually maybe compared to other young populations is doing really poorly. But almost any time you compare a really old population to a fairly young population, you're going to find that the health problems are obviously worse in the older population. So if you adjust for those basic differences, that's the most basic adjustment that we have in public health statistics. And the statistics I'm going to give you now are age-adjusted prevalence rates. Okay, let's start. I think this is alphabetically. For arthritis among adults in the United States, that's 22.1% report that. For Toledo, it's 28.2%. So that's an absolute difference of 6.1%, a relative difference of 28%, meaning that the Toledo's rate of 28.2% is 28% higher proportionally than 22.1. Okay, do you get that? And what I'm going to report on now is the relative percent, meaning the proportion that Toledo is higher than the United States rate. Okay, I hope that's clear. Okay, for asthma among adults, the Toledo rate is 19% higher. For high blood pressure among adults, the Toledo rate is 27% higher. For chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, the Toledo rate is 64% higher. For coronary heart disease among adults, it's 38% higher than the U.S. For diagnosed diabetes among adults, 48% higher in Toledo. For the mental health not good for 14 days or more in adults, it reported earlier, that's 33% higher, the 17% absolute rate compared to the 12.4% absolute rate in the U.S. Okay, for physical health not good for 14 or more days in the last 30 days, the Toledo rate is 53% higher than the United States rate. Okay, that's a bunch of health outcomes. That's kind of the end game of what we want to do is avoid disease. If you want to look at some of just the unhealthy behaviors, things that quite reliably lead to poor health outcomes, here's some more for Toledo. This one will explain a lot. Current smoking among adults. For Toledo, you're 60% more likely to be a smoker than the U.S., meaning that 26.1% of people, of adults in Toledo, report current cigarette smoking. In the U.S., that's only 16.4%. So 26.1 is 60% more than 16.4. Proportionally, again, I'm reporting the relative difference in rates. Okay, and the relative difference in rate in no leisure time physical activity among adults, a measure of sedentariness, Toledo 38% higher. For obesity among adults in Toledo, 46% higher than the U.S. For sleeping less than 7 hours among adults, 23% higher in Toledo. So, perhaps that is a little depressing. This is not anything new. This type of kind of ranking of Toledo hasn't changed a whole lot in recent decades. I used to be the health planner for the health department a couple decades ago and became very familiar with this type of stuff. And yes, we have a lot of health issues. Okay, going to switch a little bit gears. There's a whole nother set of indicators that are tracked. And the ones I'm going to report on now are as reported from americashealthrankings.org. And these are statewide rankings. So this provides a broader context of let's look at the state of Ohio, is how it ranks with other states in rates either the ranking value or the actual rates of different health issues with other states. Okay, in the general summary for Ohio compared to other states in the United States, the overall ranking that they give was 36. So Ohio was ranked 36 out of 50 states for health status. What they list as some of the strengths were: we have a low violent crime rate in Ohio. We have a high HPV immunization coverage rate among adolescent males. We have a high rate of primary care physicians. Among challenges, the top three that they listed was high prevalence of smoking, which you might remember is the number one preventable cause of death in the United States, which follows with the second challenge, is we have a high premature death rate and a high prevalence of diabetes. Some of the things that they highlighted in these comparisons was, and I'll highlight some of their highlights, is in the past 3 years, drug deaths in Ohio have increased 77%. And in the past 10 years, air pollution has decreased 37%. Woohoo! We got a good one. Okay, so let's look at some of these ranking measures and see where the state of Ohio ranked. For drug deaths per 100,000 population, Ohio ranked 49th. Yes, the opioid epidemic has been driving this, and Ohio has been very hard hit. Okay, smoking percentage among adults. In Ohio, we're ranked 43rd. For the air pollution thing, which we had a good reporting of a decrease in air pollution, which is a trend that's happened across the country, but it's great to see 37% decrease in Ohio, but we are ranked 45th among 50 states for pollution. Okay, now two indicators where we're actually in the top 20%. Okay, what I'm reporting is on indicators where we rank 41st through 50th, or first through 10th. And these are the only two of these dozens and dozens of indicators that we actually rank in the top 20%. We rank number 9 in salmonella cases per 100,000. Woohoo! Let's hear it. Let's get a big woohoo for Ohio. And the one that was alluded to earlier is we rank 10th among states in the HPV immunization coverage among male adolescents. Okay, a little bit narrow, but it's another woo-hoo. Okay, back to the bad news. The rest of these are where we're in the bottom 20%. Okay, we ranked 42nd in preventable hospitalization discharges per 100,000 Medicare enrollees. That kind of an indicator of how well our hospitals are doing. I mean, it's a general indication of the health of the population, but it also indicates a little bit more about the hospital setting. Okay, among with cancer deaths per 100,000 population, we rank 43rd in Ohio. Frequent mental distress, we rank 42nd. Infant mortality rate, 41st. Premature death rate in years of life lost before age 75. In other words, if you die at 70, that counts as 5 years. If you die at 50, it counts as 25 years. They look at all the deaths and consider it premature if you're dying before age 75. You add up all those years and look at it based on population, and we rank 42nd. Okay, well, whoops, there's even more. Sorry, a whole nother page of them. Okay, we rank 42nd in injury deaths, the rate of injury deaths. We rank 46th in insufficient sleep. And we rank 43rd on unemployment rate, a general indicator that's related to health status, a driver of health status. If you don't got money, you usually aren't as healthy. Okay, so what do you do when you're faced with this? Now, one motive could be that, you know, we're number two in health distress. Maybe we'd be number one, and maybe that kind of litany that I just read you will push us over the top, and we'll be number one. That's one potential way to look at this. I prefer that just, you know, knowing what reality is a good thing, although we need to recognize also that research shows that if you have a more accurate view of reality, you are slightly more depressed than those who have a more fantastical view of reality. So there's a plug for reality, but it cuts slightly the wrong way as far as the world being depressing, because let's face it, the world is a little bit depressing. But one way to overcome that is to compare yourself to somebody or something, some place that is worse off. So, to contrast that whole bad litany for the state of Ohio and the city of Toledo, we are going to go where? Texas. Here's a story from ProPublica.org, an investigative journalist organization, on the extraordinary danger of being pregnant and uninsured in Texas. Here we go. From 2020 through 2015, at least 382 pregnant women and new mothers died in Texas from causes related to pregnancy and childbirth, according to the most recent data available from the Department of State Health Services. Since then, hundreds more have likely perished. While their cases reflect the problems that contribute to maternal mortality across the United States, gross medical errors, deeply entrenched racism, structural deficiencies in how care is delivered, another Texas-sized factor often plays a significant role, the state's vast and growing problem with health insurance access. About 1 in 6 Texans, just over 5 million people, had no health insurance last year. That's almost a sixth of all uninsured Americans, more than the entire population of neighboring Louisiana. After trending lower for 7 years, the Texas rate has been rising again to 17.7% in 2018, or about twice the national average. The numbers for women are even worse. Texas has the highest rate of uninsured women of reproductive age in the country. A third were without health coverage in 2018, according to the Department of State Health Services survey. In some counties, mainly along the Mexican border, that estimate approaches 40%. Public health experts have long warned that such gaps can have a profound consequence for women's health across their lifespans and are a critical factor in why the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal deaths in the developed world. Texas's maternal mortality numbers have been notably troubling, even as errors in key data have complicated efforts to understand what's going on and led skeptics, including the governor of Texas, to question whether there's really a crisis. Hardly anyone outside the policy world has taken a deep look at how those insurance gaps play out for women in the second largest state in the U.S., at how, in the worst-case scenarios, lack of access to medical care endangers the lives of pregnant women, new mothers, and babies. ProPublica and Vox have spent the last 8 months doing just that, combing through government data and reports, medical records, and research studies, and talking with scores of women, healthcare providers, policymakers, and families of lost mothers around the state. We learned about Rosa Diaz and dozens of others, mostly women of color, by scouring medical examiners' databases for sudden, quote, natural deaths, then inspecting investigator and autopsy reports for clues about what went wrong. The picture that emerges is of a system of staggering complexity, riddled with obstacles and cracks, that prioritizes babies over mothers, thwarts women at every turn, frustrates doctors and midwives, and incentivizes substandard care. It's the extreme example of a fragmented system that cares about women much more in the context of delivering a healthy baby than the mother's health in and of itself, said Eugene Delarac, professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. Most of the mothers whose cases we examined were covered by Medicaid for low-income pregnant women, a state and federal health insurance program that pays for 53% of the births in Texas, more than 200,000 a year, and 43% of all births nationwide. In Texas, the program covers OB-GYN visits, medications, testing and non-obstetric care, from endocrinologists to eye exams. But the application process is so cumbersome that women are in the state have the latest entry to prenatal care in the country. It can take months to be seen by regular providers and even longer to access specialists. This poses the greatest dangers for high-risk mothers-to-be, as many women on Medicaid have no medical care for significant parts of their life. Then, roughly 2 months after delivery, pregnancy Medicaid comes to an end and the safety net gives away to a cliff. For many new mothers, the result is a medical, emotional, and financial disaster. More than half of all maternal deaths in the U.S. now occur following delivery, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, with as many as 24% happening 6 or more weeks after a woman gives birth. In Texas, Texas, the proportion of late postpartum deaths is closer to 40%, with black women bearing the greatest risk. To lose health coverage really has a tremendous potential to worsen outcomes, said Dr. Lisa Holier, chief medical officer for OB-GYN for Texas Children's Health Plan and chair of the state's Maternal Mortality Review Committee. How Texas came to have the worst insurance gaps in the country is no mystery. It was an accumulation of deliberate policy choices by state lawmakers going back decades, driven largely by an aversion to government-mandated insurance and a desire to keep taxes low. The design of our entire system is to be very limited, and historically we are very distrustful of government in general, said Texas Representative Sarah Davis, a Houston Republican who chairs the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services. Dr. Amy Raines Millenkoff, a University of North Texas Health Science Center professor and member of the state's Maternal Mortality Review Committee, believes the state's culture of personal responsibility leads it to abandon its most vulnerable. We don't have the belief here that people should have access to health care, she said. Even the safety nets are built on keeping people out rather than pulling people in. That attitude is epitomized by Texas's approach to Medicaid. The program was established by Congress in the mid-1960s to provide access to basic medical services for the poorest of the poor. In the 5 decades since, it has broadened to cover 75 million Americans, many of them in the working and middle class. States have wide discretion to set income eligibility levels for different categories of residents who receive benefits. Texas's, quote, traditional Medicaid program, the one that covers non-pregnant, non-disabled adults, is the least generous in the country. People who don't have children or disabilities can't receive Medicaid no matter how poor they are. A single mother with 2 children only qualifies if she earns the equivalent of 17% of the federal poverty level or less. That's $230 to $319 per month, depending on who's doing the calculation. That's so little, says Ann Dunkelberg, Associate Director for the Center for Public Policy Priorities in Austin, that she could work 11 hours a week at minimum wage job and she would still make too much. Every other state, even those more politically conservative than Texas, allows a larger portion of its residents to receive benefits. In Oklahoma, for example, the income threshold is 42% of the poverty level. In Tennessee, it's 95%. By contrast, the income threshold for pregnancy Medicaid in Texas is 12 times more generous, up to 198% of the federal poverty level, or $3,520 a month for a family of 3. Under federal law, pregnancy Medicaid offers a 2-month postpartum off-ramp before benefits expire. But when their coverage runs out, tens of thousands of new mothers in the state go back to being uninsured every year. The disparity between pregnancy and traditional Medicaid is a stark measure of larger social priorities, contends Allison Stube, a professor of OB-GYN at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. If a woman's value is 198% of the federal poverty level when she's pregnant and 17% of the federal poverty level when she's not, that means we're saying a non-pregnant woman is worth 91% less than a pregnant woman. Eliminating such discrepancies and improving maternal health coverage more broadly were key goals of the Affordable Care Act. The ACA envisioned expanding Medicaid to all adults who earned up to at least 138% of the federal poverty level, regardless of whether they have children or a disability. That's currently about $29,435 per year for a family of 3. But after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states couldn't be forced to accept the Medicaid expansion, Texas became one of 14 states that opted not to, a decision that has denied 1.4 million Texans of insurance who would otherwise have qualified. Even expanding Medicaid wouldn't address the other huge contributor to the Texas insurance crisis. Private insurance costs have also soared, and they are increasingly out of reach for everyone from Lyft drivers to public school teachers. Texans bear among the highest cost burden in the U.S. for their insurance, the Commonwealth Fund reports, spending 12% or more of their income on premiums and deductibles. Amy Beckman, a certified nurse midwife who splits her time between the Texas Hill County and the Rio Grande Valley, said she and her husband pay $1,500 a month for their medical insurance, plus a $13,000 annual family deductible, or $31,000 a year. My clients can't afford that, she said. For uninsured and underinsured teenagers and women, family planning clinics like Planned Parenthood have been a crucial source of preventive care screenings as well as birth control. In 2010, Texas lawmakers gutted that system, part of a push to block abortion providers from receiving any government funding in the state. As the sweeping impact of that decision became clear, policymakers raced to construct a new program, Healthy Texas Women, to replace some lost services. Now the program is only serving a fraction of the women who qualify, and many doctors have stayed away too. A vast patchwork of other workarounds have risen over the years to fill in the gaps left by a lack of insurance. Sliding scale hospital systems at the county level, free federally funded clinics, major philanthropic initiatives and small nonprofits that subsidize everything from medications to diapers. As vital as these services are, their reach is limited, especially in rural areas, and they have the unintended effect of making the system seem even more disjointed. The fragmentation is so huge, Rains Milenkov said, on paper you can cobble services together, but in practice you really can't. And when things go wrong, when women run into an insurmountable hurdle or fall through the cracks, the sense of futility and abandonment can be overwhelming. When you really, really, really need help, you're denied, one Houston mother, Krista Allen, said. That makes you feel as defeated as a human being, so defeated as a human being. Texas has the worst record of first trimester care in the country. About 21% of women who give birth in the state, some 80,000 annually, don't even see a doctor or midwife until the second trimester, according to the CDC. Another 1 in 10 doesn't start until the third trimester or receive any pregnancy care at all. Such delays can increase the risk of premature birth and infant mortality, as well as maternal complications. In Texas, almost 11% of babies are born premature. The biggest driver of Texas's prenatal delays is lack of insurance. Women can't sign up for Medicaid until they find out they're pregnant. And because nearly half of births are unplanned, this often doesn't happen until the second or third month. Then some women need to get their pregnancies verified by an approved provider. The Medicaid application itself is 16 times longer than the 1040 tax form. Any glitch, a forgotten document, a change of address, might force a delay in approval or force a redo. Other states have made it a priority to drastically reduce or eliminate sign-up delays. Oklahoma, where 100% of applications by pregnant women were approved instantly, verifies income after enrollment. 45 states and the District of Columbia consider applications within 24 hours by linking them to electronic sources such as quarterly wage data. Texas is among the handful that still require potential enrollees to send in proof before getting care. According to a Texas Medicaid spokesman, 92% of applicants are currently approved within 15 days. That's certainly progress, said Georgetown University health policy expert Tricia Brooks, but the vision of the ACA is to have a majority of determinations made in real time or within 24 hours. Even when an application is approved, simply finding a provider can present a new series of challenges. That's largely because of another Medicaid-related problem, how little doctors and midwives are compensated. In Texas, as in other parts of the U.S., providers are paid only about half as much for Medicaid patients as for privately insured ones. The going rate for an uncomplicated vaginal birth is about $1,500, the Texas Medical Association reported. That sum typically covers all of a patient's normal care, a dozen or so prenatal exams, labor and delivery, and a single postpartum checkup. For a privately insured patient in Dallas, the fee is closer to $2,700, the American Medical Association says. At the same time, Medicaid patients often are more medically and socially complex, less likely to have transportation and family support, more apt to miss appointments, or to be otherwise, quote, non-compliant. It's a system that many Texas OB-GYNs in private practice choose to avoid, capping the total of Medicaid patients they accept, limiting the number of high-risk women, or opting out altogether. The result? More delays in initiating routine care and accessing specialists. Under Texas Medicaid rules, low-risk patients are supposed to get their first prenatal appointment within 2 weeks of being approved. For high-risk women, it's supposed to be 5 days, but a 2016 study found much longer lag times. Only 71% of low-risk providers and 44% of high-risk ones met the state standard. Even in large urban areas like Dallas-Fort Worth, where Combs practices, if I have a seizure disorder patient, I refer them to neurology. The wait time is 6 months. So the shortages lead to a vicious cycle, one that explains why prenatal care in Texas often starts so late. The harder it is for a woman to find a doctor, the later she enters care. And the harder it becomes for her to secure a doctor, Most private providers won't take on new patients beyond the 28th week of pregnancy because of the medical and legal risks. Some set the cutoff as early as 20 weeks. By then, said Eric Aguiwa, medical director of OB-GYN services at the Center for Children and Women in Houston, when you see a patient with no prenatal care, with multiple comorbidities, it looks like a ticking time bomb. In the last few years, maternal health researchers in the U.S. have seen a dramatic shift in what kills, or nearly kills, pregnant women and new mothers. Historically, the leading medical causes were acute crises, hemorrhages, massive infections, blood clots. These days, the greatest risks come from chronic conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, that can escalate during pregnancy. According to the most recent report of the Texas Maternal Mortality Review Task Force, pre-existing health problems are the most common contributing factor to maternal death in the state. These chronic diseases pose risks to women and their babies at every step of pregnancy, childbirth, and the postpartum period. Women with pre-existing high blood pressure, for example, are more likely to develop preeclampsia, one of the most devastating complications of pregnancy. The condition can limit the flow of nutrients to the fetus and cause the placenta to tear away from the uterus, putting the baby at risk of prematurity or death. The immediate dangers to the mother include hemorrhages, seizures, and postpartum stroke, and in the longer term, heart disease. Ideally, high blood pressure would be brought under control before a woman conceives. If that doesn't happen, managing her hypertension during pregnancy becomes much trickier and requires careful monitoring. More and more women in Texas need this kind of medical attention. Hypertension jumped 20% in Texas women from 2005 to 2014, according to the Department of State Health Services. At the same time, pre-pregnancy diabetes rose 45% and obesity 25%. But even as chronic illnesses have become more prevalent, Texas's staggeringly high uninsurance rate means many women aren't getting treated or even diagnosed until they become pregnant. A few months of Medicaid, especially when prenatal care is delayed, often can't counter years of neglect, said Dr. Sean Blackwell, the obstetrics and gynecology chair at University of Texas Health McGovern Medical School. He and his colleagues are often left, quote, trying to prevent our train wreck patients from having a train wreck, he said. There is one category of patients who pose a particular conundrum for obstetric providers in Texas, immigrants. The state has the highest number of births to non-citizens outside of California, and many of those women are low income. The large majority can't access pregnancy Medicaid, even though most other states allow long-time legal residents to participate. Texas does have a prenatal care program for non-citizens. There's a huge caveat, however. It doesn't actually cover the mother, just the fetus she is carrying. It may be the ultimate example of the state's fragmented maternal care system and how that system prioritizes babies. The program dates back to President George W. Bush, who extended the Children's Health Insurance Program to cover unborn babies. At the time, the idea, the fetus is a child and a future citizen, and should therefore receive prenatal care, attracted more attention for its anti-abortion origins than for its potential to help immigrant mothers. In many of the 16 states that have adopted it, the type of care women receive isn't much different than what they would get under pregnancy Medicaid. In Texas, though, the differences are vast. CHIP Perinate provides benefits to about 33,000 women a month, regardless of their immigration status, up to 202% of the federal poverty line. But the program's narrow focus on the fetus ignores critical aspects of the mother's care. Doctors complain, treating her like she's the carrier for the baby, as Jiwa puts it, or a vessel, as Rains Melenkoff said. For example, CHIP Perinate only covers labor if the result is an actual delivery. The cost is usually borne by another program, emergency Medicaid. Premature or false labor, when the mother goes to the hospital with contractions that turns out to be nothing, isn't covered. Nor does CHIP pay for a mother's non-obstetric emergencies, like a rotten tooth, in danger of turning septic, or hospitalization for a serious illness. The gap extends to care for cardiac conditions, the leading cause of maternal death in Texas and across the U.S. If a woman has a history of high blood pressure or diabetes, there could already be heart damage, said Tanya Lopez, a certified nurse midwife at the JPS Health Network high-risk OB-GYN clinic in Fort Worth. One way to check is a maternal echocardiogram, a sonogram of the heart that private insurance and Medicaid would cover, but not CHIP Perinate, Lopez and numerous other providers said. Some of the program's biggest limitations come after the baby has been delivered. While new mothers get two routine checkups, those whose needs are not routine must fend for themselves. Post-delivery services or complications resulting in the need for emergency services for the mother or the perinate are not a covered benefit, Christine Mann, a spokesperson for the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, which administers the program, confirmed. Even life-threatening postpartum conditions like preeclampsia or blood clots are excluded under the program's rules, though a woman might be able to get coverage under emergency Medicaid. The greatest postpartum need is for mental health services and contraception, according to numerous providers, neither of which CHIP provides. In Shanna Combs' practice, it is not uncommon for CHIP perinate patients who don't want any more children to beg her for an unnecessary C-section so she can get a tubal ligation at the same time, an approach that turns what would otherwise be an unaffordable sterilization into just a small add-on cost, Combs said. For George Said, Chief of Obstetrics and Maternal Fetal Medicine at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, the cancer patients stand out. He recalled a case in which a CHIP perinate patient was diagnosed with breast cancer while pregnant. She needed surgery and chemotherapy. We had a difficult time finding care for the breast cancer, he said, because it wasn't the baby, and CHIP only covers the baby. Eventually, we found a place that was willing to take care of her, but that's not ideal. That's not the way it should work. The health system Said works for will absorb some costs that CHIP perinate won't reimburse. Other clinics said they often do the same, but many private providers said they simply refuse to deal with the CHIP perinate patients at all. Perinatal CHIP is better than nothing, Said said, but the fetus can't exist or survive without the mother being healthy. It puts us in an untenable situation because we are, as physicians, obligated to give the patient full care, not just care for the baby. But the scientific understanding of pregnancy and postpartum has changed fundamentally in the past few years. The 3 months after birth are now recognized as a critical time in the health of mothers and infants, complete with a new name, the fourth trimester. Even normal healing from childbirth can be a lengthy process, researchers are finding. Some of the most dangerous pregnancy-related complications, including preeclampsia, blood clots, and heart problems, such as cardiomyopathy, may not surface until weeks or months after delivery. Depression, substance abuse disorders, and heart conditions, three of the leading postpartum causes of maternal mortality in Texas and across the U.S., often worsen under the economic and social stresses of new motherhood. Instead of being a typical benchmark for recovery, the two-month mark can be a tipping point on the margin between illness and wellness, said Neil Shahn, OB-GYN and assistant professor of OB-GYN and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School. That's when you're getting the least amount of sleep, you're feeling the most socially isolated. Adding a gap insurance on top, that only seems that it's in the wrong, not only that it seems to be in the wrong direction, but it's also cruel. Medicaid benefits expire even for women who suffer health complications that are directly related to their pregnancy or deliveries. Pregnancy Medicaid can't be extended under any circumstances. Instead, as coverage ends, women are assessed to determine eligibility for other products, such as traditional or disability Medicaid. Low-income new mothers who don't qualify for Medicaid are automatically enrolled in the Healthy Texas Women's Program. But many women told us that in practice, the end of pregnancy Medicaid results in insurance freefall. The urgent need to fix the gaps in postpartum care has captured the attention of national reformers, who see it as a critical step towards narrowing racial disparities in maternal mortality. The enthusiasm extended to Texas, where a broad coalition led by the Maternal Mortality Review Task Force came together this past legislative session to support a full-year extension. The effort passed the House but stalled in the Senate. Representative Sean Thierry, Democrat of Houston, who introduced one of the extension bills, had to counter skeptics who thought that the state's alarming maternal mortality numbers were, as she said, quote, kind of a hoax, and that increasing benefits for new mothers was just a stealth tactic aiming at expanding Medicaid more widely. It's an attitude Thierry's Republican colleague, Representative Sarah Davis, has also had to contend with. Medicaid expansion, that's like a four-letter word here, Davis said. For a lot of Republicans who dominate the state house, women's health issue triggers a similar reaction. Women's health has become so synonymous with Planned Parenthood that in an effort to punish Planned Parenthood, women in general get punished. Well, folks, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.